And this is KPCW. It's 8:06 on this Thursday morning, May 14th. Currently 46 degrees in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. Heber City reporting 51 degrees right now. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Thursday, look for plenty of sunshine, a much improved day after all of the active weather and the strong winds yesterday. We're looking at highs down into the mid-60s today in Park City with lots of sunshine. We'll see those temperatures climbing into the lower 70s in the Heber Valley. As we wrap up your work week on Friday, we're going to be looking at mostly sunny skies across the Wasatch Back. We'll see those high temperatures in the upper 60s for us in Park City with highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. Again, some pleasant weather to close out the work week. The weekend brings us more changes. Saturday, we're going to notice those southwesterly winds picking back up. That's going to lead to an elevated fire danger across the region with, again, those gusty conditions out there. Temperatures will be in the mid-60s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. Now, we've got a pretty stout cold front that moves into the area as we go into your Saturday night and Sunday morning, and that's going to bring us some big changes back to the region, believe it or not. We're going to be talking about temperatures on Sunday with highs in the low 50s in Park City. We'll see those highs around 60 in the Heber Valley. Those are likely going to be morning time temperatures. We'll likely see falling temperatures during the daytime hours on your Sunday into the upper 30s and low 40s. We'll see a chance of scattered showers developing as we go throughout your Sunday afternoon and Sunday evening. And as temperatures dip below freezing into the 20s by Monday morning, yeah, we're going to have the chance, believe it or not, of some light accumulating snow potentially as we get into your Monday across the Wasatch Back, both in Park City and in the Heber Valley, as temperatures dip down into the mid-20s. Now, we will see temperatures warming up in the afternoon, so anything that falls will likely clear the roadways or anything like that, as temperatures will be in the upper 40s for highs in Park City and highs back in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. We'll dry things out, but stay a little somewhat on the cool side heading into early next week for us, with Park City seeing highs in the 50s and the Heber Valley seeing highs in the 60s. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong, taking a look at yesterday's meeting. Later on, Summit County Economic Development and Housing Director Jeff Jones has an economic update on Summit County. And finally, Katie Wang, with Executive Director of Park City Film, with a preview of some of their upcoming screenings. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include local entrepreneur Kevin Williams of Ascend AI Labs, who explores how AI has evolved from a future possibility into a powerful opportunity, and how organizations are learning to harness it to work smarter, move faster, and stay competitive. Then a look at the future of drug discovery and how AI is transforming science at its core with Dr. Matthew Sigmund, Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at the University of Utah. All of that coming up on today's edition of Cool Science Radio, heard, of course, every Thursday from 9 to 10. Well, Corey Richens maintained her innocence as a judge sentenced her to life in prison yesterday for the 2022 murder of her husband, Eric. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more from an emotional hearing in Third District Court.
The Camas area mother, who wrote a book about grief and was convicted of killing her husband, Eric Richens, will spend the rest of her life in prison. At her sentencing May 13th, her late husband's 44th birthday, Corey Richens says she, quote, will not be blamed for something that she didn't do.
I will appeal and fight these charges, no matter how long it takes. Not because I have anything to prove to this court, to the state, to the Richens family, or to the world, but I do have something to prove to you three.
Richens addressed her statements to her three boys, who were thrust back into the public eye during the sentencing process. Summit County prosecutors had argued against allowing Corey Richens to seek parole out of concern for the children's well-being. Their counselors read statements from them May 13th in which the boys expressed concerns about being possibly contacted or harmed by their mom. But Richens' attorneys asked the court for 25 years to life in prison with the possibility of parole, partly since the children might change their minds in the future. In his ruling, 3rd District Judge Richard Mrazek acknowledged the concern for the boys, who he says might grow to resent whichever sentence he imposed. He turned instead to the attempted murder that Corey Richens was convicted of when she tried to poison Eric Richens on Valentine's Day in 2022.
And then, having failed in her first effort of spending the next 17 days not changing course, but doubling down, preparing to try again, and ultimately completing the act through the administration of poison. And for what? Money.
The judge said someone convicted of those acts is, quote, simply too dangerous to ever be free.
My hope is that every person affected by Eric Richens' death will, over time, find their way to a state of peace.
The Summit County Attorney's Office, in a statement, called May 13th a somber occasion to remember Eric Richens and the loved ones mourning him. His family supports the life sentence without parole. They said as much in their emotional statements at the hearing, speaking about their grief and what Corey Richens has done to them. After the hearing, Eric Richens' sister, Amy Richens, expressed appreciation for law enforcement, the various attorneys, and family friends who helped them over the past 4 years.
Today, we invite everyone to remember Eric and his generous spirit by performing a kind act for a stranger. The world lost a wonderful man, and it will take all of us to embody his kindness.
Corey Richens' friend, Greg Hall, says her side of the family is hurting too. Many of them disagree with the guilty verdict.
He's a wonderful, wonderful, good human being, and it's heartbreaking for those of us that truly know her. And at the end of the day, I believe that justice will be served. That's all we can say right now, but I know the wheels will be turning for an appeal.
Richens' attorneys left the Summit County Justice Center without making a statement, but they told the judge they will ask for a new trial. A Summit County jury convicted Corey Richens of aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, 2 counts of insurance fraud, and forgery in March. Although the murder sentence takes precedence, Mrazek sentenced her to prison on all counts. She must serve the time consecutively, meaning she cannot earn time for 2 crimes at once. Summit County has asked for Corey Richens to pay back $1.4 million in legal defense costs and $1.4 million in life insurance she collected after her husband's death. Mrazek will decide how much, if anything, she'll need to repay at a hearing July 31st. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council met yesterday, and in the studio with a recap of the meeting, I have Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, just as part of 3rd District Judge Richard Mrazek's sentencing yesterday, Corey Richens, he said, won't have to pay any fines. She was going to be liable for payment to the estate, I believe, also about $1.5 million for the trial cost to Summit County. So that we're just going to have to pay for, and the appeal possibly as well, huh?
Well, possibly. I understand that an application is being made for a potential state grant to cover the appeal. Well, the last update that we had, it was questionable as to whether that would be available for the appeal, but if it is, that would be welcome. This has been a very, very long and expensive process.
Yeah, and I guess everybody, I mean, that's a right we have, and at the taxpayer's expense, huh? To appeal?
Well, everybody has the right to an attorney, and attorneys are provided by the state, generally by the prosecutors. So in this case, yeah, we did provide counsel for Corey Richens, and she was entitled to it. So that's where we are. That's our justice system.
Yeah. Let's move on to the discussion of Junction Commons. Yesterday's meeting was centered around the Snyderville Basin, another discussion about rezoning and then redeveloping Junction Commons. You raised the idea of finding a different zone for this, not neighborhood mixed use. So what do you mean, just creating a new zone out of whole cloth here?
Well, you know, I'm going to take it back a bit because it really does dovetail into housing. If this particular request came in without the Dakota Pacific development, without the Olympic Park development, and all of the density that comes with both, this would be an easy one for me. I think this is taking a facility that probably doesn't look or work like we would like it to. It creates opportunities for affordable housing, for other housing, in an area of density close to grocery stores, close to services, very close to transit. It ticks a lot of boxes. And it redoes a facility that does not have a lot of connectivity. So the trail connectivity that they have there, there are other things that you look at this and, you know, if you kind of created a model in your head of what redevelopment should look like and maybe think about the other side of Kimball Junction and what could happen there to redevelop gigantic parking lots that, you know, probably aren't the best way to model a community. This works in a lot of ways. But it's coming in at a time when we do have Dakota Pacific and 900 units of housing and a million plus square feet of commercial and retail and office space and the Olympic Park with hotels and some housing up there. So it's not isolated in the way that would make it easy. So it makes it a much tougher discussion. And they pointed out that we identified this area as the proper place for an NMU, and that's accurate. We put a dot on the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan that an NMU would work here. And I think we did that in 2017. We didn't have Dakota then, we didn't have other development then. And as I said to the Planning Commission last night and in the comments yesterday, if we were doing it today, which the Planning Commission is, I'm not sure we would think that ultra-high density in that redeveloped area would make sense with everything else around it that's already been entitled. At the time that we did that, it was a tech park. It was an undeveloped tech park, hadn't been developed forever. We had no reason to believe anything was going to dramatically change, but it has.
Yeah, but you mentioned later in the meeting that the county should reevaluate where that NMU zone should be applied. And I guess, I mean, so looking forward to future redevelopment, so if we're not talking about a new zone, do we talk about a redevelopment zone of some sort?
Well, I think that's what the Planning Commission is doing now, as we discussed yesterday. They will take a look at, we're about to have our own strategic planning session as a council within the next month and a half. And we do that about every 2 years. And we identify what our goals are. We try to identify what the greater challenges are over the next 2 years so that we're constantly reevaluating where we are. As part of that, that will give some guidance to the Planning Commission as they go through their, both Planning Commissions, I believe, are going through currently a process to take a look at the general plan again, reevaluate where development should occur. We have the Housing Authority that's in existence now. They're going to have some input, I would hope, in that. And we've got the public. You know, the last time we did the general plan and came up with those neighborhoods, that was extensive public engagement, assaulting people in parking lots and sidewalks of grocery stores and restaurants, saying, come over here and let's have a chat. And that's how we were able to capture that vision. But it's stale. It's a nine-year-old vision, and it's time for us to reevaluate where we are. Where would we put it? You know, if you look at the Silver Creek Village area, and Promontory, that area by the Justice Department, that's one of the areas I think we identified as possible for an NMU zone. It's not been applied for yet, to my knowledge. And, you know, a grocery store there would make some sense and keep some traffic off the road going into Kimball Junction or going into Park City for necessities. So I think there are places now that we can look at and reevaluate where we are and where housing is appropriate. You know, the housing discussion is different and a much broader discussion, but, you know, Larry H. Miller is looking at doing something on Park City's doorstep, just on the other side of 40. They've got some ideas about development in Browns Canyon, Ivory Homes, maybe that's Ivory Homes. Between the two of them, they've got some pretty big developments identified that they're concerned about, and they were chasing some legislation that would require us to impose, I think this was Ivory Homes, an urban development zone in Summit County because we're next to Salt Lake County. Therefore, we should plan for a future of high-density urban development in Summit County, which terrifies me. I'm a conservationist, and I think we should be protecting our wildlife and our resources.
Yeah. One of the big sticking points for you and others on the council seem to be the building heights of Junction Commons. So the buildings that are, what, five stories? The developers arguing, of course, that impact is minimal because of Walmart right behind them.
Well, it's Walmart behind them in terms of just what it looks like in context. But they pointed, I didn't realize, you must be aware, it's a former gravel pit. And that gravel pit was turned into that development. So it's a bit of a hole in the ground. And because it's a hole in the ground, there's not going to be much to look at from the street in terms of the height of that. It's still a bit overwhelming to me when you look at the drawing that was included in the packet. It's a lot. And I'm very sensitive as I drive through Salt Lake City and see the behemoth apartment buildings, that they, these gigantic boxes that have been built along the freeway. If you drive down Interstate 15 through Sandy and Murray and further down toward Jordan, the stuff built right next to the freeway that cuts off any view of the Ochres, you know, as you're driving along. I don't want that in our future. I resist that. I do believe that we are still rural, and I fight the notion of a housing crisis, and I keep trying to drag the council back to a notion of how much do we want to build, who are we building it for, and if we're building it for workforce, if that's one of the identified needs, 100%? Do we want all of our workforce housed here, and what is that going to take? 50%? Park City, I think, has said 15% is their goal. We haven't even gone through that, and I've been begging for it for 2 years, and we have not identified. We still stick with these terms of attainable, affordable, and workforce without diving in and saying, okay, how do we, what is our vision for this community, and what do we want it to look like?
Well, can you direct that to the Housing Authority?
The Housing Authority is independent, and I think, yes, they should wrestle with that. They will. They'll hand it back to us. But it's incumbent upon us. We are, at the end of the day, we get to set the stage. We are answerable to the people in our community, and I think we owe it to them to figure out where the values are and how to mix them in appropriately.
All right, so what could reasonably change about the project at this point? I mean, do you enter an in-depth, you know, negotiation like you did with Dakota Pacific, or?
Well, it's difficult to talk about a project that's before us. I will say that they agreed yesterday in a public setting that they were going to go back, take a look at it again, and see if they can make some adjustments. I think Councilmember Robinson expressed some irritation that the spread of affordable to market rate was 51-49. He didn't regard that as enough, especially for the impacts in the area. We did not get to the traffic study yesterday, which I believe the traffic study said that adding all of this additional density in that area is really going to have no impact on our long-range transportation plan, which feels magical to me. We'll see what that looks like.
Yeah, developers said that they're also pursuing the low-income housing tax credits, the LIHTC financing for the affordable housing. HOPA, of course, in Park City can't get those credits. So do you have a sense of how realistic that is?
Well, I think they can probably get LIHTC. I think that's available. The challenge with LIHTC is that it creates potential restrictions on the deed restrictions that we would normally impose. So if we're going to build and authorize affordable housing above base density, generally we say it's got to be offered to employees that work in the facility first, and then concentric rings building out until you get it filled, so that we are actually housing the people that we want to be housing in this area, our workforce, our law enforcement officers, whatever that happens to be in those deed restrictions. LIHTC makes that harder. As long as you qualify economically, I think you almost have to allow somebody to live there.
All right, and as you mentioned, you did have a joint session with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Anything out of that
I think just, you know, we haven't had one of those in a couple of years at least, and we used to do them more frequently. I think having that exchange of information, when you're on the Planning Commission, my understanding is it's often a guessing game as you're evaluating something as to what the council wants, where the council would like it to go one way or the other. And they're not our voice. They are supposed to follow the general plan that they help create, follow the development code that they help create, and I say help because it comes to the council for approval, and our strategies and goals. Those are the guiding lights, but they're obligated to take these applications as they come. So it often leads them wondering whether they're following what we want them to do and where the edges are. And this provides some reassurance that they should do what they think is right, that those are the guiding lights that they should follow and that they should pick up the phone and call us, not about specific applications, but if they feel a bit lost or disconnected, touch base with us and let's make sure that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, one of the thing that bubbles up from the Planning Commission is that they want to look at projects in context. That's sort of what, of course, the general plan is for. Is doing that enough to consider the overall impact of an individual decision?
Yes, I think in context is the key, and that's what we were talking about with Junction Commons. You know, you have to look at it as it relates to Dakota Pacific. You have to look at it as it relates to everything around it and what's happening around it. And I think that's fair for them to do as they reach out. Now, some of that is bounded by state law, and we know that the legislature is always happy to help us find a quicker way to get to yes for some of these projects. And that always presents a challenge and tension.
Yeah. All right. Real quick, you had there are some vacancies on Planning Commission. You filled one of those yesterday. Is this a constant battle, or is it not a problem that you've got lots of people willing to step up?
Well, we don't have lots of people willing to step up. That's the challenge. I mean, this time we had four really good candidates. I want to make sure that we're getting the message out through you, through the park record. You know, we take out ads, we let people know. Shane tells you on the radio that, you know, we have an opening, but we've got to communicate better, because this is the Planning Commission truly is the training ground for council, because that's where you learn about land use, you learn about what, you know, how things work legislatively. And I think we've got to do a better job of making it known that there are openings available. People are caught by surprise all the time.
Yeah. What other vacancies do you have to fill?
Eastern Summit County Planning Commission.
Okay. Also, finally, you keep mentioning that you're done after this term, so you are not running for re-election.
I am. No. And if you hear those words come out of my mouth saying that I am, please stop me. Just throw your body in front of it. There's zero chance. I've tried to be a good public servant, and it's time to let somebody else make that effort.
Yeah. You asked applicants for the Basin Planning Commission about legacy. Is that something on your mind now that you plan to step down?
Always. And, you know, to put it in context, we're doing a remodel of our house, and we were staying at a friend's house in Promontory for a bit, and it looked down the 40 corridor, and you could see all the way to the top of East Village down 40. And I was staring at it one day and musing about what may be coming. And I realized that we've protected almost that entire 40 reach. And on the right side, we have Round Valley. And on the left side, we've got the Promontory open space. And I pointed to it with my spouse. And I said, all of that, absent something truly bizarre, will stay like that for as long as I can think of into the future. And, you know, between that, the 910, other open space protections that we put in place, I'm really proud of what we've done. And we've been able to do it while entitling well over 1,000 units of affordable housing. So we've been able to build up that base a bit, and we're continuing to work on that. And I think, you know, my biggest fear is what council is like after Chris Robinson leaves, because he is genuinely the smartest human being I've ever served with in any context. He's thoughtful. He's willing to engage in dialogue in ways that are always constructive, and that's going to be a big loss for this council. And then we'll see kind of where it goes over the next 2 years after Chris is gone, and then we pass the baton and hope that our legacies are firm and that, you know, people are willing to, you know, to sustain what we've been able to maintain and our predecessors started. You know, when you look at the McPolin Barn and you start to think about the moat that Park City put around Park City, being able to protect agriculture with conservation easements on the east side that enable that lifestyle to continue at a slightly easier level, those are all legacies that I hope remain.
Okay. Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
What's new? What's Enduring? Making Sense of Economic Change was the title of one of the breakout sessions of Monday's Wasatch Back Economic Summit. One of the panelists on that was Summit County Economic Development and Housing Director Jeff Jones. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. So participants heard that while the economy isn't strong, it's certainly not faltering. We saw some strong job growth after the pandemic. That has kind of tapered off. We see now high inflation, escalating gas prices. We also heard how the war with Iran has decimated the energy systems that will take years to rebuild. So looking specifically at Summit County, how would you describe the state of our county's economy today and kind of heading in, you know, to the rest of the year there?
I would say that it's somewhat uncertain, but there are some, you know, for say the last couple of months, we've had, or at least from the first of the year to say current through April, we saw our general sales tax numbers remain relatively positive. We did have one bad month in March, which would reflect sales tax in January, where we saw, I think, a 13% decline, but that bounced back the next month. And then when it comes to transit taxes, TRT taxes, transit room tax, then it's declined, the last 3 months. And restaurant tax has declined the last 2 months compared to the prior year. So we have kind of a mixed bag. I did like pull some trend data out of our new tool Placer and looked at for say the month of April, looked like our out-of-market visitors declined, but in May they're popping back up again. So our May numbers may actually be positive on those types of TRT tax and restaurant tax if that trend continues.
All right, you mentioned that, and that was something I was going to bring up a little bit later, but the county has been using what's called this Placer AI application. So what exactly does that tool do?
Placer is a tool where they utilize cell phone signals and the use of say when somebody opens an app on their mobile phone or Bluetooth signals, and they get this data from a variety of sources and they dump it into a hopper and they start to separate it out. And they basically divide it out into three groups. They divide it out into visitors, and they divide it out into employees, and they divide that information out into residents. And I'm finding that the tool seems to be very reliable when it comes to as a trend and comparison tool, and maybe not as accurate when you're looking at one specific site location. But if you're like comparing data from year to year, then in addition to say our visitor numbers and our TRT tax numbers, I also compare it to our employee numbers, where we have a lot of really solid information coming from the Utah Department of Workforce Services and other tools, and those trends seem to match that. So that gives me confidence that the tool is doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, so what kinds of mobility or consumer patterns can you track with the software?
Well, we can look from trend to trend and see whether or not we have more out-of-market visitors. And the way in which Placer identifies out-of-market is that it defaults automatically to someone who stays within, that comes from outside, say, the county, and stays a minimum of 10 minutes. We can change the threshold of that review and bump that up to, say, 150 minutes and see if there's any difference in those trends. We can go back to 2019 and compare 2019 through, say, current year. And the great thing about it is because our sales tax is about a two-month lag, somebody spends that money in January, we don't see those numbers until March. But with Placer now, I'm trying to work on an internal market where we can be a little more predictive and say, well, if out-of-market visitors declined in April, I know that my June TRT collections are probably going to be down. and just remove some of that uncertainty going forward.
All right. Well, then back kind of to the reporting, you kind of went through the tax numbers. What sectors are showing the most strength right now?
Well, within the presentation, we didn't really look at individual industry groups. We didn't really have time for that. I think one of the things that we did talk about were nationally, gross domestic product was estimated like as a 2% increase for 2026. And of that 2%, normally you find that consumer spending makes up, you know, 3/4 of that or 2/3 of that contribution to GDP. And what was really fascinating in the analysis is that now gross private domestic investment, mostly centered around new AI infrastructure, actually passed the consumer spending, which is the traditional driver of economic power.
Right. And so what does that tell you?
That tells us that, and then when I, you know, if you dive in a little deeper, once again, I didn't have time to do that during the presentation, but even on the consumer spending side, then the majority of that was in services as opposed to retail products. And then it also shows you just this large, you know, investment that's taking place in AI infrastructure across the country. How that all shakes out, I don't think, you know, we know at this time. I think there are a lot of unknowns with that. And I think that there are going to be some things that, you know, over the next, you know, 5 years, we're going to see kind of a shakeup happen within traditional sectors. I mean, one thing that kind of jumped out is like the education market in general. So looking at some of the changes to education that's occurring is that just for this last year, folks who earned the unemployment rate for those with a master's degree is actually a little bit higher for the first time than those with an associate's degree. So I just think there's a lot of new things that are sort of happening, and they're happening relatively quickly. And, you know, I think the direction from Phil and myself is that communities and companies need to stay nimble in order to react to these trends.
I think it was you who mentioned that Deer Valley's East Village would create some 3,000 jobs, and those currently living in Wasatch County but working in Summit County may decide to save some gas money and no longer be willing to come into town. How concerning is that? I mean, because when you talked about just the number of new jobs that are created every year, it's like, for what? I mean, it was just hard to believe that we have that many new jobs here in Summit County.
Yeah, in Summit County, we've generated, on average, between 750 and 1,000 new jobs every year. And that trend is projected to continue. Right now, it's estimated that we have 31,350 jobs. And that's a combination of what we call QCEW jobs, non-QCEW jobs, and self-employed. And that number is projected to grow to 44,632 by the year 3036. Of our current employment base, we import from Wasatch County about 3,000 workers a day. And whether or not the area will be successful in continuing to recruit or gather that workforce from Wasatch County with the new development that's happening in Deer Valley East, I think is somewhat uncertain. And I'm sure that will also, depend upon compensation. If workers feel like it is worth it to drive that extra distance, then that's what they will do.
So where do we find those 3,000 jobs, and, you know, or maybe even half of those, I mean, that will still be willing to come? I mean, that would, you know, that aren't willing to come is, I guess, what I'm trying to say, right? I mean, so where do those come from, especially if they're even having to travel further distances, say, from the Salt Lake Valley?
Yeah, and we still, you know, we import workers from a variety of zip codes and a variety of counties. But, yeah, the challenge will probably, you know, that'll probably be a little bit more difficult going forward. And, you know, there are also lots of other projects that are happening in surrounding counties that are also going to pull labor to those types of projects if they pay, you know, a higher wage. Mm. And so this is where I think there needs to be a lot of community dialogue and a lot of community discussion about, well, okay, we're presented with these challenges. How's the best way to respond to those challenges?
And I think I heard this correctly, is that we had heard that the area median income is actually declining. Any idea why that might be happening here?
Area median income declined a little bit. It declined from $168,600 in 2025 to $167,700. And this is for a family of four. And in Wasatch County, it declined from $136,400 to $136,200. So kind of a minor drop there. Area median income has dropped before in Summit, Wasatch counties. It happened back in from say 2016 to 2017. So it does happen on occasion, but in, you know, the previous couple of years, it had actually been rising about 10 to 12% per year. And the change in area median income can be from, you know, a variety of things. It can come from you're taking lower paying jobs and those are coming into an area or expanding in an area, and higher paying jobs are leaving the area. I don't believe that that's what's happened in Summit County. The other way in which area median income can change are if you have, say, a large percentage of those who are retired that move into an area. And so the income that they would normally earn is reduced because in retirement they're not earning at the same levels that they were. And we probably have some of that going on.
One other topic I wanted to touch on was, can you talk a little bit about how closely housing affordability and economic development in Summit County are, how closely tied those are?
Yeah, I think that that's going to be the challenge, going back to your question about, you know, labor and being able to find labor. For, say, a two-bedroom house at 80% AMI, if we use a 5% down payment, a 6% interest rate from, say, the Utah First Home Rate, throw in a calculation for private mortgage insurance, an HOA fee of $300 a month. That house needs to be priced at about $400,000 in Summit County. And if you were to just jump on and, you know, do a search through realtor.com or something like that, you'd probably find that there's not a whole lot of $400,000 houses in Summit County. And the market rent for that two bedroom is around $2,800, I think, right now. And so that's still a lot for people who are, say, earning in the, you know, between the 40 and 60% area median income. And so if you're trying to grow your worker population, a more, you have a higher percentage of workers locally, then there probably needs to be increased subsidy in order to make that happen.
Yeah. Okay, we could go on and on, but Jeff, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Jeff Jones serves as Summit County's Economic Development and Housing Director. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. And on the phone with me now from Park City Film, it's Executive Director Katie Wang. Good morning, Katie. Well, let's start with, it's the annual Utah Film Showcase happening tonight, huh?
Yes, yep. This is our second annual Made in Utah Film Showcase. The reason I say second annual is because this is kind of the 2.0, the evolution of local filmmaker Jill Orschel's Filmmaker Showcase that she founded in 2005. So we've kind of revamped it a little bit, put it under our Made in Utah umbrella. But, you know, obviously so grateful for what Jill created and are excited to build on that legacy. So tonight we have 10 short films, 5 narratives, 5 documentaries. And this is really meant to be a showcase and celebration of Utah filmmakers and the incredible talent we have in the state. We have films that touch on immigration, disability, identity, the ability of art to lift people up. So just kind of runs the spectrum of topics, but just, again, celebrates just the incredible talent we have here and the work that's being done. So we'll have a panel discussion after the film with 3 of the film teams about who gets to belong, stories of place, identity, access, and home. And then a filmmaker's lounge will wrap it all up that if everyone is invited to participate in, so you can mix and mingle, find new people to collaborate with, or just talk about the art of film, which of course I love. Showtime is 7 p.m. tonight and admission is free. And of course, beer and wine will be available for purchase if you are so inclined. So really excited to be able to bring that back this spring.
Okay. And so they're all Utah directors, huh?
Yes. So when we expanded the Made in Utah program, we basically wanted to support filmmakers that live here in the state of Utah. Some are homegrown, some have emigrated into the state, but also films that are shot in the state of Utah. I believe tonight all of the films are by Utah filmmakers. We don't have, sometimes we'll have films that are shot here, but the filmmaker lives somewhere else. But tonight's program, I believe, is all Utah-based filmmakers, which is exciting.
Okay, and then you have got tell us a little bit about the Christophers that'll be showing this weekend.
Yes, so our weekend feature film premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival last fall. And this is the newest film from director Steven Soderbergh. And The Christophers is a story about artistry, authorship, and legacy. Amazing performances by Ian McKellen and Michaela Cole. This story centers around a once famous artist and his children's attempt to forge his lost masterpieces before he dies. So a little bit of a dark comedy. Again, amazing performances by the 2 lead actors. So that'll be Friday and Saturday at 7, and then again Sunday at 6. And then we're really excited to be ramping up, actually, for the summer for the first time in our 31-year history. Normally, this time of year, we're kind of rolling things up and, you know, wrapping up before as the school year ends, and then we usually end mid-June. But this year, we're continuing throughout the summer, so we've got some exciting new programming that we're bringing online that I'll talk about after I talk about, kind of give you a little preview of what we have coming up in the next month. But we have Space Cowboys is next weekend's feature film over Memorial Day weekend. And this is a documentary about skydiver Joe Jennings, who continues to push the boundaries of aerial cinematography and skydiving. I think a perfect way to kick off the summer with just those boundary-pushing stories and adrenaline rush. And then we're super excited that Cookie Queens is going to be a special screening on Wednesday, May 27th. We're partnering with She Money on this Sundance hit about the joys, pressures, and pain points of Girl Scout cookie season. We'll have director Alyssa Namias for Q&A after the film, and then She Money will be hosting the Women's Voices Forum Spring Social before the film, also with Alyssa. So you can check out our website at parkcityfilm.org for details on the social, and then register for free tickets for the film. We do expect this to sell out because it was extremely popular at Sundance. It won the Audience Award at South by Southwest. We've got a lot of Girl Scouts here in our community, whether they're active or alumni. Definitely wear your uniforms if you've got them. So please sign up now while you can. And then we're at the end of the month, we'll have Steal This Story, Please. This is a documentary about journalist Amy Goodman and her daily news show, Democracy Now! The film is both a call to action and a celebration of resistance, and poses the question, what happens to democracy when the press surrenders to power? So definitely a thought-provoking film. And then we wrap it up with I Swear, which is based on the true story of John Davidson, a Tourette syndrome campaigner growing up in 1980s Scotland when little was known about the condition. This is a story about the transformative power of friendship and community. So great slate of films coming up in the next month, and then, of course, more to come for the rest of the summer, which is exciting.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. It sounds like rather than weekend screenings, you're just kind of doing a night here and there?
So, well, it's kind of a mix because we have some, you know, major events happening in the community, like, you know, 4th of July parade, kind of hard to program against that since there's literally nowhere to park. but then also the Kimball Arts Fest, Song Summit. So we're programming around other major events that are happening, kind of just being cognizant of the space and not trying to do too much. But we're also doing a couple of collection series of films over the weekend. So the first being America the Beautiful, that'll be at the end of June. And these are four films that celebrate and showcase the diversity of the American experience and the American people as we come up on the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So we'll have documentaries about the legacy of slavery and how that story is being told in the South in the present day, Indian boarding schools, Asian American cinema. Robert Nakamura is the kind of the father of Asian American cinema, but also, you know, as a young child, as a Japanese American, was incarcerated at Manzanar in California. And then we're super excited to be bringing back Billie Jean King's documentary Give Me the Ball, which premiered at Sundance, and as hopefully most people know, she's an amazing activist around women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights, but really giving some space for those conversations. We'll have Q&As after every single one of the films with the directors or with the panel discussion in the case of Give Me the Ball. So just a great way to engage with communities that perhaps might not get as much recognition on the major celebration on July 4th, but certainly are what make our country, I think, beautiful. The diversity is certainly what makes us stronger of our country. And as a first-generation American, it's really important to me that these stories are told, and I think for our community members as well. And then in July, we're partnering with Ballet West, and this is kind of where it's a little bit less of the weekend schedule, but more kind of specialty screenings. We're partnering with Ballet West for Raising Voices on Point. They're doing a series of events in the middle of July, and we're showing a film about the movement to update classic ballet choreography to remove racist Asian stereotypes. And we'll have a Q&A with Adam Skloot from Ballet West and the founders of Beyond Yellowface. And then Best Day Ever, which is a doc about Greg Dorso and Ali Bianchi, who are adaptive mountain bikers who are working to create the world's first fully adaptive trail network. So some weekend films, but then also, as you mentioned, special screenings kind of throughout. So definitely check out parkcityfilm.org, see what's happening, you know, what the nights are, mostly on the weekends, but maybe not quite the same schedule that you're used to from the winter.
Okay, looks like you're still, have put up another audience survey.
Yes, so we've got a new audience survey. Thank you for mentioning that. That closes on the 17th. We definitely want to hear from folks as we expand our programming. How we can improve what we're doing. You can win prizes, free tickets to movies, free participate in that. You can go to our website or on our social media channels. We've got links to the survey as well.
Okay, you cut out quite a bit there. Yeah, not sure, just the internet connection went down. Katie,
can you hear me, Leslie?
Yeah, you're kind of cutting in and out
sorry.
Now. So, yeah. All right, anything else you want to mention? Okay, looks like we've lost her then. That's Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film. And again, as she mentioned, you can find out a lot more by going on to parkcityfilm.org. You can see right there at the bottom of the page the audience survey, which you can click on and give them your feedback. Well, Heber City residents are pushing back against a proposed cell phone tower in a downtown neighborhood. KPCW's Grace Dorfer reports planning commissioners want the city to have a plan for future tower applications.
More than two dozen locals attended a Heber City Planning Commission meeting Tuesday to protest plans for a 65-foot cell tower in their neighborhood. The tower, which is proposed for a site near the Wasatch County Health Department along East Center Street, would require a zoning change because of its height. Commissioners listened to objections from nearby neighbors for over an hour. Some residents, like Kylie Butler, asked the Planning Commission to consider putting the tower in the nearby cemetery instead.
We were told placing the tower near the cemetery would be inappropriate because it would be disrespectful of the deceased. And I want to ask this honestly. If it is considered disrespectful to place this tower near those who have passed away, then how is it respectful to place it directly behind the homes of people who are living here every single day?
Others, like Kenny Turley, worried about potential health impacts for their families, especially their children.
I have a 10-year-old son with hearing aids. And so it's like, oh, is this going to affect interference or anything? I have no idea.
Radio frequency emissions from cell phones can sometimes cause problems for hearing aid users. Several residents invited the applicant, Atlas Communications, to visit their neighborhood and see how a tower would affect their homes. Jared Jones compared the scale of the plans to a bee flying around the room.
If anybody's seen the bee or the wasp that was flying around, back there it didn't look big, but when me and him was right there, that sucker was huge. Okay, so when you're close to it, you feel the impact of what a 60-foot tower was going to be.
The Planning Commission proposed a master plan for cell tower coverage. The commissioners asked city staff to revisit the cemetery as a possible site for the tower. They'll discuss cell towers again at their meeting May 26th.